This is a special presentation from ABC 3340, Palm Sunday Tornado.
I remember taking the hand of Hannah, who I was sitting by, and Amy Woods, I think it was, and running.
Because nobody knew which way to go. We didn't know what was coming. And just in an instant, everybody went in different directions.
I just remember running. I don't remember which way. We just all grabbed hands and ran.
I looked up, and all I seen was a black cloud. And I seen cars coming over, and it's just stuff falling. I seen it.
And that time you could see the huge tornado, and there was just debris all in the air, pieces of house, a car that was flying upside down that winded up landing in the front of the churchyard.
I remember thinking, ooh, something just hit me in the head and it hurt really bad. And I fell. I fell on my shoulder. And then I stood up, and I was one of the first ones to stand up. That's why I don't think I blacked out or anything. And I was one of the first ones to stand up, and it was like a battlefield.
Palm Sunday services at Goshen United Methodist Church were literally ripped apart by a tornado. The twister struck the church in Piedmont, killing 19 people, including Pastor Kelly Clem's daughter. But she says the church will turn tragedy into triumph.
Neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will ever be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord.
So that video that you just saw was from 1994. It was a tornado that struck on Palm Sunday, which is actually this Sunday, the Sunday before Easter. And it was at the Goshen Methodist Church in Alabama. The kids were doing a pageant of Jesus entering in to Jerusalem on a donkey. And that's when the tornado struck that little church. It killed 20 people in all, and all were at a church. Where is God in all that? We're in a series called Greater Than, where we're celebrating how God is greater than all the things that plague us. And it's an important series because we're in the middle of basically a plague. And so any series that talks about a greater than God would be incomplete if it didn't talk about how God was greater than our sufferings. And Christians believe this. We have believed this for thousands of years, that God really is greater than the suffering that we go through. But we've got a lot of suffering right now. I wanted to show that video at the beginning because 8 days ago, on a Saturday night in Jonesboro, Arkansas, an F3 tornado tore up our sister city. And tens of millions of dollars worth of property damage, dozens of people were hurt. But what was so bothering about that to me is that we got this global pandemic going on right now. Everybody's, you know, afraid or anxious or have some concern about the virus. And right in the middle of that, this giant tornado just wreaks havoc on this city. And a lot of people that we know and care about were affected. And if you're a Christian, you believe God could have stopped that. Speaking of what God could stop, God could, with the snap of his fingers, stop this pandemic right now. You believe that God can, if you're a Christian, you believe God can part the seas, God can heal the sick, and God can raise the dead. And yet, just a few years of life experience makes you start to question things because there are too many unparted seas. There are too many unhealed sick people. There's too many people dying. And so if you've got any kind of heart at all, there's a part of all of us that starts to ask, where is God? Why are things the way they are? And the truth is, the Christian story, as told by the Bible asks that question over and over again. The prophets are relentless. The Psalms are relentless. How long is the world going to be the way it is? Because the Christian story has always said God bears responsibility about this, some responsibility. And yeah, there's human free will, but God allowed us to have that kind of free will. So the way things are, on some level, are laid at the feet of God. Do you ever wonder why people these days, why more and more people find it hard to believe in God? 500 years ago, almost nobody didn't believe in God. Everyone was a believer in some form or another. But these days, almost all of us have friends or family members or people that we care about who don't believe in God. And often we, you know, this comes up at places like Christmas or Thanksgiving where we're talking to relatives and, you know, maybe you believe in God and they don't, and they ask you, have you read Richard Dawkins? And you ask them, have you read this C.S. Lewis book? And sometimes it becomes a competition of who's read the most books, and that's if it goes well. But did you ever wonder when and why people stopped believing in God? Not that the majority of people will. I believe the majority of people, deep inside of us, we have this human yearning for God. In fact, contrary to popular opinion, the world isn't getting more secular. It's actually getting more religious all over the world. But it's also getting more secular in America and places like Europe. Because people need religion. It's always going to exist. But the people among who it tends to be the hardest, the question of where is God, why are things the way they are, tend to be people who are educated or, you know, middle class or above, and people of European descent. And since I'm in that group of people, and maybe a lot of us participating this morning are in, I want to talk about why secularism has become an option in the past few hundred years. In the last year that Leslie and I and our family lived in Texas, within the course of a few months, I did the funeral of a six-day-old baby and a two-year-old who was killed in a car wreck. I also did, within those few months, a funeral of one of my favorite persons who's ever lived. Her name was Joanne. Eden, our oldest, and I used to go to her assisted living and eat lunch with her and her husband. And she died from complications from surgery for cancer. And right in the middle of the surgery, they realized she didn't actually have cancer. And that made doing the funeral so hard because the whole thing just felt meaningless. I mean, this woman really did make the world a better place. Everyone who interacted with Miss Joanne was blessed. And it was like the world was robbed of this wonderful person. That's heavy. You know what else is heavy? I think of the brothers and sisters in our church who have both the privilege and the responsibility and the heaviness of caring for special needs kids. I think of our brothers and sisters in our church who have cancer, and to them it feels so arbitrary and scary. One of the problems with being in ministry is after a while, those kind of stories start to pile up on you. Because nobody just comes to the church to say, hey, everything's going fine, just checking in, wanting to let you know. No one just drops by the church to say that kind of stuff. People tend to come to ministers when they need a minister. And there's something about doing this kind of calling that every now and then you just step back and feel overwhelmed by the weight of it all. And sometimes there's this haunting question that starts to build up in me. What if God's not actually real? What if we just made this all up? Because if there is a God, why is the world the way it is? Now, typically when I'm thinking that way, I'm not thinking about the creek that runs in our backyard or long meals with good friends or how beautiful Arkansas is in the spring or, you know, sunrise from my deck. I tend to not think about stuff like that when I'm thinking about where is God. The famous psychologist Abraham Maslow actually said, all you have to do if you want to be reminded of things to be grateful for is go to the hospital. And then all of a sudden in the hospital, you're reminded of the simple blessings of everyday life that we take for granted. Things like being able to urinate or sleeping on your side or to be able to swallow or scratch an itch. But most of the time, when I'm going through hard times or when people I love are going through hard times, I don't think about those blessings. I get tunnel vision on the suffering. Typically, when I go down those roads, it's hard for me to see all the good that is in the world. And as a side note, I think it says so much about the human condition that what we call acts of God or tornadoes and tsunamis and plagues and viruses, when we're talking about the acts of God, we're not talking about the Buffalo River. We're not talking about the Grand Canyon. We're talking about the bad stuff, as if God only does stuff that's bad and not all this wonderful stuff that's in the world. Because it's easier to blame God in the bad moments than it is to praise God in the good. But by the way, I get it. I'm like some of you. Sometimes life is hard, and I'm not sure if at the end of your life, if you could put all the joy, all the great things that have happened to you on one side and all the bad things that have happened on the other, if you would think that the joy and the good stuff outweighed the bad. Maybe. Maybe not. But one thing I'm sure of, I bet almost all of us think the world ought to be a better place. Some of us have given our life, some of us are teachers, given our life to making the generation a better generation. Some of us are doctors and nurses or in the medical profession. We're giving our life right now to help the world be a better place. And over time, what can happen to even the best of us is we start to realize we're working so hard, but it doesn't seem to be putting a dent in anything. And then sometimes we start to think, maybe we care about this more than God does. And by the way, God, where are you in all this? And why is it the way it is? And so we come to the end of ourselves, we snap and we shake our fist at heaven and we say, why, God? Why? So back to that church on Palm Sunday. It was in 1994. 140 people had showed up. They were right in the middle of this, you know, Sunday pageant where all the kids were on the platform and they were acting out the story of Jesus coming into town on the donkey. And the minister, a woman named Kelly Clem, had a four-year-old daughter who looked up at her, tugged her dress and looked up at her and said, I want to be in the story too, Mommy. And that was when the F4 tornado hit and killed those 20 people, including Hannah, the four-year-old. When I first heard that story, it was so hard because I heard that story when we had our own daughter, Hannah, who was four. And right in the middle of all that, they were filming because it was a kid's pageant. And because they caught the whole thing on tape, that old news show that was kind of trashy news, hard copy, offered $50,000 to Kelly Clem for the copy of that tape. But she said no. Because there's no amount of money that's worth airing that kind of pain and tragedy. Because she had lost a kid in that moment. She had she had several bones broken. But the whole world, because of the news of this, because it happened on Palm Sunday, because it happened to a church, the whole world joined in kind of lamenting and trying to make sense of why this happened. And in that moment, Kelly actually said, One of the greatest points of this whole thing is that there is no point to this. That these weeks, the week when we celebrate Jesus going to the cross, Holy Week doesn't make sense. One of the things that those of us who grew up in church forget often is that today the cross is the most meaningful thing that has ever happened in human history. But in its day, it was totally meaningless. One of the main points of the cross is that there is no point of the cross. People crucified the Son of God in the most cruel, inhumane way. When people left the hill where Jesus died, nobody was thinking about, well, look on the bright side. When people walked away that morning, nobody was thinking about there's, you know, silver lining to this cloud. No, what they were thinking when they walked away is that the people who have the biggest swords and the longest spears are the ones who get all that they want. And while Rome crucified hundreds of thousands of people, we really only know a handful of the people they crucified, because that was the point. They crucified nobodies, and Jesus was killed on a cross meant for a nobody. Now, if you're new to Christianity or just checking it out, one of the things that's interesting is we have four different stories of Jesus in the New Testament. Four different: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And they all tell the stories a little bit differently. And when it comes to the cross, the Gospel of John is the most different. John tells the story emphasizing different things. And if you have a Bible, you can turn to John chapter 19. We're going to start in verse 5. Because Jesus comes out, they've mocked him, they've dressed him like royalty in a, a crown of thorns and a purple robe. And the Roman governor Pilate said to them, "Here is the man." As soon as the chief priests and the officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify, crucify." But Pilate answered, "You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." The Jewish leaders insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid, and he went back inside the palace. "Where do you come from?" he asked Jesus. But Jesus gave him no answer. "Do you refuse to speak to me?" Pilate said. "Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no power if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." He's talking about Judas there. And then skip on to verse 16. "Finally, Pilate handed him over to be crucified. So the soldiers took charge of Jesus. Carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with him two others, one on each side, and Jesus in the middle. Pilate had a notice prepared and fastened to the cross. It read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." Many of the Jews read this sign, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and the sign was written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek, so everyone could read it. The chief priest and the Jews protested to Pilate, "Don't write the King of the Jews, but that he claimed to be the King of the Jews." And Pilate answered, "What I have written, I have written." And then skip on down into verse 28. Later, knowing that everything had now been finished and so that the scriptures would be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I am thirsty." A jar of wine vinegar was there, so they soaked a sponge in it and put the sponge on a stalk of the hyssop plant and lifted it to Jesus' lips. When he received the drink, Jesus said, "It is finished." And with that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. If you grew up in church, none of that, what I just read, sounds surprising. Mainly because we've kind of been desensitized to this. We think of crosses as, you know, symbols that are on buildings or, you know, things that you can wear in necklaces. But for the first few centuries of Christianity, there were no religious paintings of a cross. Some of you have been to the Roman catacombs and you've seen, they paint all kinds of religious things. They paint the Jonah in the well. They paint Daniel in the lion's den. But they did not paint people on crosses because they had seen crucifixions. And anyone who's ever seen a real crucifixion knows you don't want to memorialize that. For those people who had seen the crucifixion, they knew the cross isn't reverent. It's the opposite of reverent. Jesus was killed a slave's death. They stripped him naked. He was disposed of. His body was going to be disposed of, and a handful of people would have only known about what happened. And here's the point the Gospel of John wants you to get. Jesus not only allowed this, Jesus chose this. Pilate thinks he's in charge. Pilate is threatening with his power. And Jesus looks at him and, like a stone cold boss, says, "Pilate, you aren't in charge of anything except that which is allowed for you to have authority over." John is telling the story different than the other three Gospels. Having done all that Jesus chooses to do, he gives up his spirit. It's a very different way to tell the story. It's one of the greatest things about the Gospels. They all have, you know, slightly different angles. And from John's point of view, he wants us to understand nobody takes Jesus' life. Nobody. Jesus is not a victim. Jesus is choosing this. He is choosing to lay down his life. And why John wants you to know that is because he uses a very different word to talk about the shame that Jesus would have undergone, the suffering that Jesus would have undergone as he was being crucified. And the word John repeatedly uses over and over again is glory. When you look at this shamed, beaten man, I want you to see the glory of a greater than God. And Jesus didn't just die this way. Jesus lived this way. See, Jesus never played the God card. All throughout the Gospels, in all the Gospels, Jesus never played the God card when it would help him get ahead. Jesus didn't use the, you know, I'm the Son of God, so I should get the, you know, corner office. Jesus never said, "I'm God, so let me have that really nice table in the restaurant, even though I don't have reservations." And the reason Jesus never did that is because you can't do that. The reason Jesus laid that card down is because you can't pick it up. When we go through hard times like this one, it's so hard to make sense of it. We want to make sense of it. Some of us came to Christianity because we were in a hard time and we wanted it to help us make sense of it. Instead, we found something else entirely. Christianity does not offer anyone a neat way of explaining away suffering. The problem with all those neat theories to explain away suffering is that none of them work. All throughout the Bible, God never tries to explain the existence of evil in the world. Instead, God does this. God chooses to die. Okay, I know this has been heavy so far this morning, but just stick with me a little longer. This is going to be a really sharp left turn, but I think it'll pay off. I want to show you some pictures. Have you ever seen those pictures that when you first look at them, you're like, well, that can't be right? And at first it looks like, you know, you're seeing something and you don't understand what it is you're seeing. Like, for example, this one. This is a picture of a woman. It looks at first glance like she's got a foot hand, but then you realize, oh, it's just the perspective of the camera. She doesn't have, you know, like the weird X-Men mutation that appears to be useless. No, it's just the way the camera angle was. Or what about this woman? I love this because it looks like she's a centaur. But then you look again and you're like, oh, no, it's just a woman who is, you know, making a sandwich and she's got her dog behind her, but totally looks like a centaur for a second. Speaking of dogs, what about this woman? Dogs can really mess up selfies. I hope that's what is happening, or otherwise she's having a very bad day. You see, it's actually just a dog snuck in and messed up the picture. Or what about this guy? It looks at first glance, this is my favorite, it looks at first glance like this guy is wearing a beautiful wedding dress on a beautiful spring day. And then you look again and you realize, oh, he's walking in front of a water fountain at the wrong time. So here is a picture. I want to show you a picture. What's behind this cardboard thing is a picture of two basketballs. And when you first look at the picture of the two basketballs, it's obvious, like, well, they're both the same size. They're, you know, just sitting next to each other. But part of that's because of the way the picture is taken. But look at what happens when you see it from another angle. The reason I like this analogy so much is C.S. Lewis was once quoted as saying something like, the first words when we all get to heaven are going to be, oh, now I understand what's going on. But for right now, we don't. We have a limited perspective, and with our very limited perspective, there's a temptation to make us think that we understand everything that's happening. Like, we've all, you know, had those moments where we walked into the wrong bathroom and we realized it was the wrong bathroom, and so we started arguing, or we didn't realize it was the wrong bathroom, so we started arguing with the women that were in there that they all got the wrong bathroom, and then it finally dawned on us, no, it was us. We've all had those moments, right? It's not just me. No, maybe it is just me. Here's the point. All of us have great confidence in our ability to make sense of life and to perceive reality. We often go through life wrong, but never in doubt. And if this is true about the million little things in life, about, you know, forced perspective on pictures or seeing things from the wrong angle, if it's true of a million little things, why do we not assume so quickly it couldn't be true about the bigger things? The reason more and more people don't believe in God today is not because life has gotten worse. It's because we think we've gotten so much better. There's a Canadian philosopher named Charles Taylor who's done a lot of work on this, and I'd love to sit down with you and explain it sometime if you're interested. But his big idea is over the last 500 years, the reason that people don't believe in God anymore is not because we you know, used to believe in dragons and fairies and elves and things and God and things like that, and now we've evolved and we don't have faith like that anymore. He said, no, we've replaced one set of faith for another set of faith, and the main set of faith we replaced it with was the ability of human reasoning to be able to understand everything. Therefore, we think if we can't understand why everything is happening, then there can't be a good reason for it to be happening at all. The people who have lived before us, our ancestors, they didn't sit in judgment on an infinite God because they realized they had limited capacities to be able to understand things. Charles Taylor, this philosopher, says it was only when our belief in our reasoning, our ability to be the master of the universe began to increase, we started to think suffering was an argument against the existence of God. There's this one preacher in Manhattan that I like, Tim Keller, who actually says it this way. He says, there is then a significant amount of faith behind a modern argument against God on the basis of evil. It is assumed, not proved, that a God beyond our reason could not exist, and therefore people conclude that he doesn't exist. But it wasn't true that their reasoning had undermined their faith. Instead, it was that a new kind of faith, one in the power of human reason and ability to comprehend all things, had displaced an older, more humble, self-effacing kind of faith. Here's what that means. When life gets hard, when we struggle with doubt, when everything goes south and we're trying to make sense of it, we begin to try to help other people make sense of it, as if we had any idea the totality of what God was up to. And sometimes we say stuff that actually hurts other people. You know, sometimes we say things like, you know, God needed another angel. And if you've ever said that, I'm not picking on you. But we don't know the inventory list of God's angels. We try to make sense of it and try to explain exactly why God does stuff. But God's answer to suffering was never to explain it. Never. Not once in the Bible does God try to explain the why behind all the suffering. Instead, what he does is enters into it. We assume there's got to be a reason why the world the way it is. If there was a reason, we'd be able to understand it. And since we can't understand it, since we can't have an explanation, there must not be a God, never realizing how much God might be up to that we have no idea about. You know what's interesting about crucifixions? Even when they did started painting them, it wasn't like the paintings. The loincloth is there because they're trying to make more reverent something that was never reverent. And they weren't necessarily up on very tall poles. They were down low enough so that people could hurl insults and mock and shame them. That's what happened to Jesus. As if the pain wasn't enough, people from Jerusalem turned their back on it and began to make fun of him. And there was another historical figure around that day. We don't know much about him. All we know about him is at some point he turned to a life of crime. Maybe it was because of his childhood. Maybe it was because of the Roman oppression. Maybe it was because they taxed him at half of their income and the Romans weren't starving and the Jews were. Maybe it was because of the poverty he was born into, but for some reason, at some point in his life, he turned to a life of crime and eventually terrorism. We know that Rome thought he was enough of a problem that they decided to kill him, like Jesus. They stripped him, they stretched out his arms, they nailed him to a cross, and they stuck him in the ground low enough where people could look him in the eyes and shame him. But unlike other crucifixions that day, he was crucified with a popular Jewish rabbi. He knew it was that rabbi because they put that sign up, King of the Jews, over it. And because he was crucified with that rabbi, there was such a large crowd there watching and mocking. Jesus, weren't you going to bring the kingdom of God? Jesus, we thought you were going to save everybody. Why don't you start with yourself? Why don't you do another magic trick, Jesus? And we don't know exactly what the rebel said, but the other gospels tell us at some point, even while he was dying, this guy joins in mocking with Jesus. Even though crucifixion, you die by suffocation, he uses his precious few breaths to start making fun of Jesus too. And while we don't know what he said, I have a hunch I know why he said it. I have a hunch that I've heard stuff like this in jail cells, in hospital rooms, in funeral homes, and sometimes right after church. Because at some point in your life, when things get hard, you want to blame somebody. You want to try to make sense of it. And if you can't think of a good explanation, then you'll just reach for a cynical one. God, why is it like this? Is there even a God? Why am I going through this? And this guy, he wants to shake his fist at heaven, but he can't even do that. So he does the next best thing. He joins in the crowd mocking the guy who's in the same boat he is. Because all the stuff that had happened to him, all the poverty, all the bad things that had led him from the person he wanted to be into this person. And now there's this gap for him between the God he thought existed and the God that apparently didn't exist. What the God he expected and the God he got. And the question he's got underneath all of it is, why God? But the great irony of this day is that if any point he would have changed his question from why God to where are you, God? His answer would have been 10 feet to your left. Where are you, God? Right next to you. Have you ever confused life because of life? Have you ever confused life with God? Have you drawn conclusions about God on prayers that were answered or weren't answered? There are times in everybody's life where we go through something that we can't understand. And there are times when all of us, when God seems impossible or a million miles away. But here's what this story means. Don't let your pride fool you. We don't know nearly as much as we think we do. We're not the masters of the universe we thought we were. And in those moments where God feels so far away, don't fool yourself into losing sight. God might be closer than your next breath. So back to that church in Alabama. The minister, Kelly, wouldn't sell the copy of the tape to hard copy. She did something much more powerful. Because there were all these stories that were caught on that tape. Like one was her friend Diane, who when the tornado started to hit, she leaned over her 3-year-old nephew Tyler and threw her body over him. And it cost her her life. But Tyler, the 3-year-old, walked away with scratches. There were so many little stories like that. And so one at a time, she invited every living member of that church to come to her home and watch the video. And it helped them heal. They had to relive over the worst day of their lives. But in hindsight, they could see God right there. Here's what the minister Kelly says. She said, "But here and there, in spite of why, we constantly found a gleam of hope. Where was God, people ask? But we had 100 little gifts reminding us that God is here, that it's God's story we're living, that as Jesus promised his disciples, he will not leave us as orphans in the storm." This is what it means to say God is greater than our suffering. It's not that suffering isn't hard. It's that God is greater than those hard times, and our greater than God is always going to be with us. Listen, I know that recently we've heard that the virus, things are going to get worse before they get better. And there's a possibility to give in to fear and anxiety. And there's some of us may be affected by this in adverse ways. Some of us are home alone and may be anxious. But listen, you may be home alone, but your greater than God is there. You may be scared and worried about your future, but God goes before us and behind us, and you will never go through something that surprises him or makes him abandon us. And even when we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, especially when we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, God is with us. God will never leave us or abandon us. Your greater than God has always been with you. So where is God, church? Closer than you think.